We're going to take a look today in our sermon time at something which I believe is not entirely unknown. It certainly will not be I made the same comment up in Trenton, and I didn't realize how accurate it was. What I was going to say is, I'm not saying that nobody in this room has ever thought about this, or that nobody in this room has ever read the part of the Bible we're going to read. I don't believe that. I found out how correct that was when somebody came up to me and said, everything you covered in the sermon today, I spent most of this past week reading the exact same material. So, I mean, I'm not saying this is somewhat, that this is well known, but I'm saying it's somewhat well known. And it might be, I think I'm safe in this, it might have been a while since you've looked at this part of the Bible we're going to look at. I'm going to tease you for a while. I'm not going to tell you exactly what it is. I'm going to drop a few hints. And as up there, I'll start looking out here and I'll see some light bulbs going on. And I'll know you're way ahead of me. You already know. But I'll give you a couple of hints before we turn there. So again, it's a somewhat known, but perhaps a not very well-known incident in biblical history. Perhaps we haven't read this, all of us at least, very recently or very thoroughly. I think I'm on safe ground there. Now, besides that, besides the fact that it's not well-known, what would well-known be? I think Ten Commandments would be well-known. Sermon on the Mount would be well-known. Leviticus 23, the festivals among us, those are very well-known. This is not so well-known. This is not so often referred to. But another hint, something about this passage of the Bible we're going to be looking at. There's some unusual aspects to it. Some unusual aspects. I think by the time we finish, you will agree. Some of the things we're going to read about are a little bit unusual. They don't necessarily follow the normal pattern of what we might expect when we're reading the Bible. Now, what do you mean by that? Well, if for no other reason, the part of the Bible we're going to be looking at is unusual for this reason. I think there are other reasons that it's a bit unusual, but if for no other reason, it's unusual in this regard. It involves not a prophet. We're familiar with prophets. There's all kinds of prophets mentioned in the Bible. It doesn't involve a prophet. It involves a prophetess. It involves a female prophet. You say, yeah, a pagan. No, a true prophetess of the true God. There's all kinds of prophetesses and false ministers and of both sexes of false pagan religions. No, this is a true prophetess of the true God. So that makes it a little bit unusual. I'm seeing a few light bulbs going already. Some of you may be way ahead of me. But if for no other reason, it's unusual for that reason. Not a prophet, but a prophetess. And here's another thing, another little clue or hint. This prophetess is a central figure to this story we're going to look at. But this story doesn't have just one central figure. It has two. And guess what? Both central figures of this story are both women. Now, that's a little bit on the unusual side. Not a bad thing. It's a little bit unusual. Usually when we read stories in the Bible, we don't expect both central characters, more light bulbs going on, both central characters to be women. Now, some of these light bulbs may be false light bulbs. You may think you know, but you might not. So hang with me here. Yeah, both central figures are ladies. Beyond that, there are other aspects of this story that are just a bit unusual, I believe. Maybe unusual for this in this regard. One of these women, one of these two central characters of this story, one of them takes a leadership role in the army of Israel. She goes to battle, not with the army, but at the head of the army. We don't expect that usually. This lady is actually leading the army of Israel into battle. That's a little bit unusual. She leads the leading general, a man, into battle. The second central character in this story, also a woman, turns out to be an assassin. That's a little bit unusual. A heroine, one of the leading figures in a Bible story, a woman turns out to be a cold-blooded assassin. A cold-blooded assassin of a particularly brutal sort, as you'll see here. Maybe we could call her a sweet assassin. A sweet assassin. So we got one lady leading the charge in of Israel's army, and another one, a sweet, silent assassin. Would you agree? A little bit unusual. Now, this is a story, and as all Bible stories, it's a true one. I don't think you could make this story up. It has to be true. Nobody could make this up. It has to be true. It's in the Bible. And besides what I've already said by way of hints, on a slightly more serious note, it's like all true stories in the Bible. I'm going to use some adjectives to describe the story, not the characters, but the story. It is instructive. It is an example. In other words, it's not just for entertainment. It's to teach us. There are things we can learn from this. It's instructive. I'm going to use a series of words that the Bible itself uses about these stories. It's instructive. It's an example. It's an admonishing story. It's a warning story. There's admonishment, stir to action, but there's also warnings. If we know where to look, there's a warning in this story. That's pretty important. But beyond that, it's even more. It's a comforting story. If we know where to look, there's comfort. And finally, it's a hopeful story. There is hope to be found in this story. It's helpful. It's hopeful. It's a teaching story. There are some fairly deep, important spiritual lessons in this story. Romans chapter 15 is a statement that says all of that. Romans 15 and verse 4. This is an all-inclusive statement. It's in the writings of the Apostle Paul. It's inspired. God wanted this in the Bible. When I say it's an all-inclusive statement, just look at it. Romans 15 and verse 4, it says, whatever things. That's pretty all-inclusive. Not just a few things. Not just one or two. All. Whatever. Whatever things were written before. He's talking about all the Old Testament, all the stories in the Old Testament. The point of reference here is the Old Testament scriptures. And here's a overall, kind of a sweeping statement. Whatever things were written before were written for our learning. So there's learning. There's a lesson. These are teaching stories. They're not just entertainment stories. For our learning, that we through the patience and comfort, there's comfort in these stories if we know where to find or look for it. And we might have hope. There's hope to be found in this story, just like all Old Testament stories. There's a similar statement made over in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Oh, you know, I forgot to make one announcement, but it ties right in here. I was going to say, we'll give you some kind of a... Those of you whose eyes have lit up, like, oh, I know what he's talking about. I was going to say, we'll give you a prize. We will give you a prize. I'll even give you a prize if you get it wrong. I have a son-in-law visiting this weekend who got two boxes of brand new 12-foot tape measures. They're over here. Anybody who wants one can have it. If you want two, you can have it. So they're sitting over here. They're for the taking. He got a good price on them. Zero. We gave away a bunch of them up there. There's still plenty left. So here they sit. If you want a 12-foot, brand new, unused tape measure, take one, take two, doesn't matter. All right, so whether you get it right or get it wrong, you can have a prize. But this is 1 Corinthians chapter 10. I asked him last night if I could have one. He said, if you'll take two, you can have one. I mean, he's trying to get rid of these things. All right, 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 11. Now, all these things, once again, that's a pretty all-inclusive statement. All the accounts, all the stories in the Old Testament, all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, our warning. That's one of the things I said these stories have. They have some warning in them, even for us. Well, for whom? I just said, for us. How do I know? For us, on whom the ends of the ages have come. Now, is there anybody in this room that doesn't think we're near the end? I mean, they even thought in one sense they were near the end back 2,000 years ago when he said, us. Well, if end times were then, it's certainly end times now on steroids. You know, if you have a 6,000-year deal, even if you're into the... If 4,000 years are in the rearview mirror, you're 4/6, you're 2/3 of the way through, you're in the last third. Yeah, you're in end times. But what if you're at the end of 6,000 years? You're really in the end time. So there's admonition, there's warning. And what that says is, not only did these things happen so that we could learn and be admonished, but God saw to it that they were recorded. I mean, things could have happened that he never saw had recorded in the Bible. But not these things happened, and they were written. So not only did they happen, but God wanted them written down so we could read them. All right, so these are pretty important stories. All right, now I'm going to tell you who it's about. We'll see how many of you deserve the prize and how many of you just get one. Deborah. The story of Deborah. I see a few people going like that. So a few of you got it right, I know. We're going to look at the story of Deborah. Now remember, I said there were two key central figures, and they were both women. Deborah's one of them. We'll talk about the other one just a little bit later. But she, I already told you, she's an assassin. She's a lady, she's a sweet lady, so we'll call her the sweet assassin. So this is a sermon about Deborah and the sweet assassin. That's what we're going to look at today. Now, the story of Deborah and the sweet assassin is found in Judges chapter 4. That's where the narrative of the story occurs. Judges chapter 4. The next chapter is Judges chapter 5, and that's the poetic recounting of the same story. So you got history, narrative in chapter 4, and more of a song of rejoicing about what happened in chapter 5. We won't even get to chapter 5. 4. But before we go to chapter 4, we need some background. So we're going to get to chapter 4 verse by verse, but I think first we need a little background. The story of Deborah and the sweet assassin, it takes place in the time of the judges. Now again, I don't know how recently you've thought about the book of Judges or read the book of Judges. But to put it very mildly, when we're talking about the time of the judges, and the things that are recorded in the book of Judges, this was not the greatest of times in Israel's history. It was among the worst of times in Israel's history, in many ways. This was a tough time to live. It was certainly a tough time to serve God. This was a rough time. Not the greatest of times in Israel's history. In fact, there is a verse at the very end of the book of Judges that gives us an overall evaluation of the entire period of the judges, covered in the history of the book of Judges. We can turn to that. It's the last chapter and the last verse of the book of Judges. Judges chapter 21. And it tells you this was not the best of times. I mean, it really makes that point if we know some other Bible verses. Here's the overall assessment of those days, the time of the judges, time of the book of Judges. Judges 21 and verse 25. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Now when you turn people loose to do what is right in their own eyes, what else does the Bible tell us usually is going to happen? There is a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof is the way of death. There's going to be a lot of death, dying, chaos. There's no strong leadership at this time. They don't have a king. They certainly don't have a righteous king. Episodically, they would get a judge. God would send a judge to help them out when they got in trouble. They'd cry out to God. Send them a judge. The judge would help them. God would help them through the judge. The judge would pass from the scene, die, and they'd go right back into doing what was right in their own eyes, and that usually ends up in trouble, big trouble. From that one verse, the very last verse of the book of Judges, there's a lesson. Whenever the people of God, the unique people of God, the only nation who've ever been privileged to know God, know the true God, have the true God be their king, whenever the people of God break loose from God and righteous leadership and start doing what's just right in each person's own eyes, it doesn't take long for chaos to be the result. Chaos, suffering, bad things, weird things, horrific things. There's a lot of horrific things mentioned in the book of Judges. We just read why. They didn't have leadership, strong leadership, righteous leadership. Most people were just doing what they wanted to do, what they thought. So horrific, weird, out of control things happen. And the longer they go in that posture, the worse it gets. Now, I mentioned that the chapter that includes this story is Judges 4. We're not ready to go through every verse of it quite yet. There's still some more background. But I do want to turn to chapter 4, maybe put a marker there. I just want to read a verse or two. This sets the stage for what we're going to read about the time of Deborah and the sweet assassin. Verse 1 of Judges 4. When Ehud was dead, the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Eternal. Now, when you look at that carefully, first we say, who's Ehud? Ehud was a previous judge that God had sent in his mercy to bail them out. The last time they got into real trouble, they cried out. God was merciful. He sent a judge. God used the judge to give them a form of deliverance. But he's now dead. This first verse of the chapter that includes the story of Deborah tells us already there are problems. It doesn't say the children of Israel did evil. It says they did it again. There's this cycle. I guess I should start on the down cycle. They go, everybody doing what's right in their own eyes. Terrible evil, terrible chaos, a lot of death, dying, horrible things. They cry out to God. He sends them a deliverer. That deliverer goes away. We start the cycle again. So they're back in the cycle. There's no judge. There's no righteous leadership. Everybody's doing what's right in their own eyes. Terrible evil, terrible levels of evil. Ehud is gone. There are consequences when people or individuals do just what is right in their own eyes and disregard what God has revealed. There are consequences. Now, the second verse tells us in this case what the consequences were. So the Eternal sold them into the hand of Jabin, the king of Canaan. This was a form, clearly, of God chastening his people. It says he sold them into, he let them be conquered by somebody named Jabin, the king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander, the general of this pagan king's army was Sisera, who dwelt in Harosheth Hagoyim. Harosheth Hagoyim is a somewhat mysterious term, the scholars tell us. But some of the ones I referenced think it just means the wooded area. It's not the name of a city so much as a general wooded area, a lot of maybe hills and forests, up in the northern part of Israel. You know, Judah is down in the south. Benjamin is kind of down in the south. But some of the tribes were up in the northern part. One of the tribes that was up in the northern part was Naphtali. And that's the area probably of this, the area of Harosheth Hagoyim. Many of you have Bibles in the, maps in the back of your Bible. Sometimes you could look at that. Sometimes they'll show you where the various tribes settled. Up north, you have Issachar and you have Naphtali. Some of those tribes. That's where the action is in the story of Deborah. Zebulun's up there, Naphtali's up there, Asher's up there. It's up by the Sea of Galilee, up north, to the west of the Sea of Galilee. So again, the verse says, the Eternal sold them into the hand of Jabin, the king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. Hazor is up north. It's a northern city. The commander of his army was Sisera, who dwelt in this wooded region, Harosheth Hagoyim. Now, if it's been a while since you read the book of Judges, that might be odd to you to read that. You say, wait a minute, king of Canaan. Canaan's the promised land. I thought God gave the promised land to Israel. What is there a pagan king still doing in Israel, in Canaan? What's he doing there? Weren't they all supposed to be run out? When the Israelites crossed the Jordan River, weren't they supposed to wipe out or run out of town? All of these pagans, all these tribes? What's there a king of Canaan doing? They're right in the middle of it, of the northern tribes of Israel. Weren't they all supposed to be either gone or dead? And the answer is yes, they were. They were all supposed to be gone or dead. Well, why weren't they? I'm going to make use of a little expression that was used in the sermonette up in Trenton today. It really caught my ear. Maybe you've heard it. Life is hard, but it's even harder when you're stupid. Have you ever heard that? Sometimes, you know, it's hard enough when we do everything right, but if we do dumb things, sometimes it even gets harder. We bring some of the trials that we face on ourselves. So what is there a king of Canaan, an enemy of Israel, a pagan enemy? What's he doing right in the middle? Weren't they supposed to all be gone? The answer is yes, they were. Why weren't they? Because Israel didn't run them out. They were supposed to run them out. They didn't. They brought this on themselves. That's why there's a king of Canaan right in there in the middle of them with an army, and why God doesn't have to go very far to find somebody to use to discipline his people. God sold them in the people up north. He sold them into the hands of this king of Canaan. Well, he was right there living among them. And God sees to it that he gets the upper hand. And he oppresses them. And he doesn't oppress them for a month or a year. As we see, it goes on a long time. So to the question that might have come to our minds, what are they doing there? Shouldn't they all be dead or gone? Answer, yes. Now this story, like all stories, is a teaching story. So here's one of the earliest lessons we learn. There is God's original intent. There's what God wants to do as he works in people's lives. Actually, it's whether it's ancient Israel or mine or yours. It doesn't matter. This is a consistent theme we see in the Bible. This is something we can learn from these stories. God has an original idea in mind. He has original intent. It's what he wants to do. But some of that is contingent or dependent on us cooperating. On us cooperating. For instance, this starts with mankind's start. He gave Adam and Eve a beautiful paradise, Garden of Eden. It wasn't hard work to live there and have plenty of good things to eat. All they had to do was keep their hands off of one tree and its fruit. The original intent, it would have been a wonderful paradise. But life's hard, and especially hard when you're stupid. And so they stupidly listened to the deceiver, and it got a lot harder on them. It got a lot harder. Now in the sweat of your brow, you will, and there will be thorns and a lot of other things that didn't have to be there. Oh God, here's this pagan general who's been oppressing us. A part of God's answer is, yeah, you brought it on yourself. Can you learn that lesson? Can you and I learn that lesson? So it was God's original intent that all those previous inhabitants of Canaan would be gone, either dead or run out of the country. He intended for his people, originally, to be blessed in such a way that they would possess the land of promise, Canaan, all to their own. They wouldn't have to share it with the previous inhabitants. That was God's original intent. It would have been much easier for Israel. God's original intent was that Israel and only Israel would now have the promised land, and that they would be unencumbered, untroubled, unoppressed by any remaining Gentiles there, because they wouldn't be there. That's what God wanted and intended. But Israel's got to cooperate at least a little bit. There's a little bit of contingency. I'll do this, but you got to cooperate a little bit. Now, we're going to see what that meant, cooperate. What does he mean, cooperate? We'll see. Yeah, so God's original intent was for them not to have to worry about any king of Canaan with a powerful army oppressing them right in their own country. And if they would have done what God wanted them to. Now, what did God want them to do that would have led to that result? Initially, it was very simple, but very hard. Originally, all they had to do was trust him to do it all for them. Who's going to get rid of all these Canaanites? The original plan is God says, I'll do it all for you. But here's what you have to do. You have to trust me to do it. Don't start taking things into your own hand. Don't start thinking you've got a better way to do it than me. Originally, that's all they had to do. Just trust God to do it his way. I'm going to read that. We're going to read that together. Originally, that's all they had to do. Trust God to do it his way on his time schedule. They would have not had to have any weapons. They wouldn't have to exert themselves. What they originally could have done is just stand here and watch God do it. Get rid of all the inhabitants. God was willing to do that, original intent. Let's look at some of that background. Exodus chapter 23. God makes it very clear what the original intent was. If they had done their part, and initially their part was just trusting him. Exodus 23 and verse 20. Now, sometimes Jesus talked about himself in the third person, almost like he was talking about somebody else, but he was talking about himself in some role. Sometimes he would say, the Son of Man came to do this. Well, he could have said, I came to do this, but you know what I mean? Sometimes he even talked about himself in a role, the Son of Man. I mean, you could go to your child and say, I told you not to do that. You could say, your father told you not to do that. It might have a different impact, you know, honor your father and mother. Just an example. So God sometimes talks about himself in various roles in the third person. And that's what's going on here, really. So here's, or it's potentially what's going on here. He talks about an angel that would go with them. But it could be his presence in that way. Here's Exodus 23 and verse 20. Behold, I send an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Well, in the New Testament, we're told the rock that followed them was Christ. Well, might there have been a special angel? Yes, but in some ways he might just be talking about in his capacity as an intervener on their behalf. Well, anyway, beware of him and obey his voice. We're to obey God's voice. Well, do not provoke him, for he will not pardon your transgressions. When is it an angel's authority to pardon or not pardon? So, I don't want to get hung up on that point, but it could be just God talking about, I'm going to go with you, but he's saying an angel, an intercessor, a spiritual presence. Don't provoke him. Better obey him, for my name is in him. But if you indeed obey the voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy. Now he's using first person. I thought it was the angel. I think it's the same. I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. My angel will go before you and bring you into the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Canaanites, Hivites, Jebusites, all these people that are already living in Canaan. I'll cut them off. If you skip down to verse 27, well, how's God going to do that? God has a thousand ways of doing things that we can't even imagine. How about hornets? If you want to get rid of a bunch of people living in a house, and you want to move in that house, I'll tell you one way to get rid of them. Send about 1,000 angry, buzzing hornets in every window of the house. They're out. They're gone. You don't have to do anything. You just wait till they're gone, then the hornets go, and you can move in. That's what God was offering. Verse 27. I will send my fear. That's another thing God can do. He can make people afraid of you. They'll run away from you. You don't have to lift your arms in with weapons in them. God can make them so afraid of you, they'll run away from you. He offered to do it. I'll send my fear before you. I will cause confusion among all the people to whom you come. I'll make all your enemies turn their backs to you. That means they're running away from you. You didn't have to kill them. You didn't have to run them out of town. God's doing it for you. And I'll send hornets, lots of hornets. I'll send hornets before you. He could have said snakes. There's ways to clear out a country that God can do. Hornets. You shall drive, which shall drive out the Hivite and all these other people. Now, I won't do it all at once. It won't be in one day. And even for that, God had a reason. I will not drive them out before you in 1 year. Because if all the people take off because of hornets or fear and leaves all the animals, who's taking care of the animals? Nobody's taking care of the animals. Some of the animals will get hungry. They'll go crazy. They'll turn savage. You don't want to lead your people into a land full of a bunch of hungry, ravenous animals. So God said, I'm going to do this in a measured way. Little by little, I'll drive them out until you have increased and you inherit the land. He said, and the reason I'm doing it little by little, not all in one day, is, again, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. God had this all figured out, original intent. Israel, if you'll trust me, if you'll obey me and trust me, I'll do it for you. Well, that's original intent. God says, I'll cut them off. Now we go to another. Let's go back to Judges for a second. We just want to get this background that helps us really understand why we get to the first verses of Judges 4. We see Israel in the fix that it's in, being dominated by an army and a king of Canaanites. And why are they still there? We're looking at the background to why they're still there. Judges chapter 2. And verse 22. I made the same mistake I did up there. Verse 21. Let's start in verse 21. Judges 2, we'll start in verse 21. We're a little bit further into this background, and now look at the words God uses. I also will no longer drive out before them any of the nations which Joshua left when he died, so that through them I may test Israel. Test, chasten. You know what? The hornets option is off the table. Plan A, original intent, Israel wouldn't accept the easy way, just like Adam and Eve wouldn't accept the easy way to live. Because of their decisions, there were consequences. Hornets option's off the table. God says, I'm no longer going to run them all out. All you have to do is stand and watch me. I'm going to leave them there. I'm going to leave them there. And from time to time, when you need chastening, I'm going to use them to chasten you. That didn't have to be the way it was. Israel brought that on itself. So that through them I may test Israel, whether they will keep the ways of the Lord, to walk in them as their fathers kept them or not. Therefore the Eternal left those nations. Some of the work of driving them out or killing them had been done. That sounds harsh. Not quite so harsh when we realize there's a second resurrection. And God's going to give these people a chance to come up in a much better world. You didn't want to live with those Canaanites. You read about some of their practices. That was rough. They were totally into Baal worship and other paganism. There was child sacrifice. It was a horrible place. Those people, actually many of them, would be better off dead. So that's what God was going to do. He was going to let them die, clear the land of them, or if they ran and got out, they could maybe escape that way. They're going to have to be dead or gone. It's actually better for them in the long run. But God says, now I'm going to leave them there, and the hornets option is gone. And the 100% removal option is gone. I'm going to leave them there. You brought that on yourself, Israel. As you and I go through stories like this, remember, it's for admonition, it's for warning, it's for instruction, it's also for hope and encouragement. But God doesn't really change all that. He says, I don't change. I change not. Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, and forever. So this is a pattern of how God deals with people. He wants to give us plan A, the deluxe model. He wanted to give it to Adam and Eve. They rejected it. They got plan B or C. Not nearly as easy. Same here. But this is a way that God deals with people. And Jesus commented on it in Matthew chapter 19. This is Jesus as a human being on the earth commenting really on what he was doing back then and what I think God continues to do. There's a consistency in how God does things. And we see it. We can be admonished by it. We can learn about it in some of these stories, even in the Old Testament. If we're the people upon whom the ends of the ages have come, it really is important to learn these lessons. What was God's original intent with regard to marriage? One man, one woman, for life. Adam, Eve, for life. That was God's original intent. So Jesus is on the earth, and his critics said, "Oh, I think we can paint him into a corner." Answer this one, Jesus. If that's the case, how come Moses let us have divorces? They thought they had him, and Jesus gave this answer. You brought it on yourself. That's not a blessing from God. You brought it on yourself. Matthew 19 and verse 8. He said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts. It was not God's original intent to permit divorce of any kind for any reason. It wasn't in the plan. It wasn't in the plan A. But it didn't take long in God working with the nation of Israel for them to show they weren't going to do it His way. And so He put in accommodating statutes that managed the problem. And what Jesus is saying is, if you're a converted person, you will try to discern God's original intent and go back to that. This temporary permission of divorce for this, that, and the other reason. He said, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. That wasn't God's original intent. And the converted mind, Old Testament or New Testament, looks in the Bible and with the help of God's Spirit, discerns God's original intent, the gold standard, and tries to live that way. So a little bit more about the background. Now we go to Deuteronomy chapter 9. Original intent, they'd all be gone. By the time we get to Judges 2, God says, I'm going to leave them there. I'm going to leave some of them there, and I'll use them from time to time to chasten you. Yeah, like in chapter 4, verse 1, King Jabin, the king of Canaan, and his army led by Sisera. That's what was going on. But more of the background, Deuteronomy chapter 9, start in verse 1. A summary of the wilderness wandering years, those 40 years that they'd wandered in the wilderness. The older generation had died out. A retrospective about what was all the background to that. Why has it taken us 40 years to get to the promised land? There's a reason. So here's some of that. Deuteronomy 9, verse 1. Hear, O Israel, 9:1. You are to cross over Jordan today. This is 40 years on. Joshua is going to lead them. Moses isn't even going over. You are to cross over Jordan today and go into dispossess. Now we get back to that. What's the plan? If you're dispossessing people, you're getting them out. You're not accommodating them. You're not going to live next to them. If you're dispossessing them, you're getting rid of them. You're to cross over the Jordan today, but the hornet's option's gone. Now you're going to have to participate in driving them out physically. All right, so go into dispossess nations greater and mightier than yourself, cities great and fortified up to heaven, a people great and tall, the descendants of the Anakim, whom you know, and of whom you heard it said, who can stand before the descendants of Anak? What can this one little nation do to drive out these giants? Well, if this one little nation has the true God behind them, it's easy. If the true God is for us, who can be against us? That's a lesson of ancient Israel. It's a lesson of the modern church. If God's for us, what do we got to be afraid of? What can't be done if God is working through His people? So that's the answer. The people of God, with God behind them, can run out the children of the Anakim. Look at how big they are. Think of a whole tribe of Goliaths. Apparently these Anakim were huge. Understand, therefore, today that the eternal your God is He who goes over before you as a consuming fire. Not even the sons of Anak can stand before a consuming fire. He will destroy them. God will destroy them. Now, not with hornets. You've got to get your hands dirty now. Originally you didn't. And bring them down before you. So now it's you shall drive them out and destroy them. It's not the hornets. You've got to get your hands dirty and help. So which is it? Is it God driving them out, or is it you driving them out? It's God driving them out through you, through your involvement. You can't just stand back and watch the hornets do it, or fire do it, or fear do it. That's off the table. There are consequences when we refuse God's plan A. Doesn't mean we can't be in the kingdom of God. It means there are consequences in this lifetime. Now, verse 4 says, do not think in your heart after the eternal your God has cast them out before you, saying, well, because of my righteousness, the eternal has brought me in to possess this land. Don't get self-righteous, Israel, thinking that you're so good that God is doing this for you. But it's because of the wickedness of these nations that the eternal is driving them out from before you. They deserve to be driven out. And the ones that won't run deserve to die. That's God's judgment. It's not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart that you go into possess their land, but because of the wickedness of these nations. Now, if that's anything, it's almost an understatement. The wickedness was so deep, so profound, there were sort of many vile, horrific things going on among these Canaanite tribes. Archaeology has even uncovered some of those horrible things, remnants of it, artifacts. It's now time for God to say, those people have lost any right to live in this land. I'm going to give it to my people. That he may fulfill the word which the Eternal swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So here's another point for us to ponder, to learn about. When God is doing something, sometimes God has multiple objectives that he's simultaneously accomplishing. One is to fulfill his promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God is a promise keeper. When he promises Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, their descendants are going to get this land, their descendants are going to get this land. When it's time for God to get rid of the Canaanites, he gets rid of the Canaanites. Originally, he was going to get rid of all of them. Now he's going to get rid of many of them, if not most of them, but not all of them. But God does simultaneously several things in this one act. Well, that still is true today. In learning about God's workings among people, sometimes we learn this lesson. God is accomplishing multiple objectives, affecting multiple people, all at the same time. It could also affect his timing, because it doesn't just impact one person waiting for his intervention. It might affect a number of people, and that might help explain the timing. And in fact, in this case, we don't have to speculate. That is exactly what we would look at to understand the timing. Not because we speculate, but because God actually says, that's why I'm doing this now, and I didn't do it earlier. Hold your place. Well, let's go to Genesis 15. Why is it now time for Israel to get the promised land? And why is it now time for the Canaanites to, most of them, be run out? We don't have to wonder. Back in the time of Abraham, this is even before his name was changed to Abraham, God talked about this very issue. When will those who already live in Canaan, Amorites, Hivites, Jebusites, Canaan, when will they lose their right to live there? Immediately? No, God says it's going to be a while. It's not my time yet. You have to wait till it's my time. This is Genesis 15 and verse 13. So God is dealing with this man, Abram. Later his name was changed to Abraham. But Genesis 15 and verse 13, he said to Abram, know certainly. You don't ever have to wonder if it's going to happen. You might just wonder when it's going to happen. What's going to happen when it's time for it to happen. But it will happen. Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs. Well, this is talking about the whole Egyptian period of time. They will be strangers in a land that is not theirs and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge. Afterward they shall come out with great possessions. So there's an exodus out of Egypt on the way to Canaan. Verse 15. Now as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. But in the fourth generation, not now, but way down in the future, in the fourth generation, they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Those tribes that were living in Canaan, even now, they were living terrible, sinful, idolatrous lives, but it wasn't yet time. It wasn't yet time. God says four generations. We might say God's going to give them four generations to repent. If they had repented, maybe it would have happened to them like it did to Nineveh. God sends a prophet to Nineveh. Against all odds, Nineveh repents. The time of their punishment was put off. But God says it's not now. So here's a lesson, another admonition, a warning, a lesson. What God can do today, he could have done 400 years ago. But he chose not to do it 400 years ago. He chose to wait 400 years and do it today. When it's his time, he'll do it. He's telling Abraham, this isn't going to happen right now. Your descendants are going to get the land, but way down in the future. It's not my time to give it to them yet. When it's my time, I'll give it to them. That's a lesson about dealing with the true God. It's his time schedule. So we go back now to the book of Deuteronomy, and now it's chapter 20. Will we ever get to Deborah? We will get to Deborah. But when we get to Deborah, this background will now make it so easy for us to kind of go right through the story. We'll know the background. So now we go to Deuteronomy chapter 20 and verse 16. Again, it's when do we get the promised land? When do we get the cities of the promised land? All right, this is, and under what conditions do we get them? Chapter 20 and verse 16. But of the cities of these peoples, which the Eternal your God gives you as an inheritance, you shall let nothing that breathes remain alive. Utterly destroy them. So now we're back more into the original intent deal. God originally was going to remove all these pagan tribes from the promised land. Nothing that lives is to remain alive, that breathes is to remain alive. Utterly destroy them. Hittite, Amorite, Canaanite, Perizzite, Hivite, Jebusite, just as the Eternal your God has commanded you. And there's a reason for that. Lest they teach you to do according to all their abominations. They are going to pull you down. You're not going to pull them up. They're going to pull you down. God knows people. And so God deals with people, whether it's ancient Israel or the church. There's always this theme, come out from among them. You're not going to lift them up. They're going to pull you down. And God told them that. But they thought they knew better. God, that's kind of harsh. Kill them all? What about the sweet, cuddly ones? What about the ones with good personalities? When people start thinking that they know better than God and they're going to amend his plans, it doesn't end well. That's pretty clear. Nothing that breathes is to remain alive. That's people or animals. Clean slate. Utterly destroy them. And again, they're going to pull you down otherwise. So verse 9, well, go down to verse 6. Now, did God really think they were going to do that? Therefore, understand that the Eternal your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness. You're a stiff-necked people. In telling them what plan A or A minus is, he's telling, I know you're probably not going to do it. You're stiff-necked. Life's hard, but it's harder when you're stupid. Now we go to Numbers chapter 33. And verse 50. All right, Numbers 33 and verse 50. God keeps telling them the same thing over and over as if it's important for them to do it. He also says, I know you probably won't do it, but this would be easier for you if you'll just do it. Otherwise, we're going to have to go to plan C or D. And you won't like it as much. You might think you will. Numbers 33 and verse 50. The Eternal spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan, across from Jericho. It's just about time for Moses to die and for Joshua to take the people across the Jordan River. Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you have crossed the Jordan into the land of Canaan, you shall drive out all the inhabitants. Drive them out or kill them. None are to be left. Drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you. Destroy all their engraved stones. Destroy all their molded images. Demolish all their high places. Dispossess the inhabitants of the land and dwell in it. I've given you the land. It's not theirs anymore. It's mine to give, and I'm giving it to you. It's not theirs anymore. You shall divide the land by lot, by an inheritance among your families. And the lot fell to Naphtali to be up north, just to the west of the Sea of Galilee. Verse 55, if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, it shall be that those whom you let remain shall be irritants in your eyes, thorns in your sides. They shall harass you in the land. Yeah, like the king of Canaan. Jabin and his general Sisera. And moreover, it shall be that I will do to you as I thought to do to them. So Judges chapter 1. So they get across the Jordan River. What are they going to do? What do you think they're going to do? So here's a story of what they did and what they didn't do. Judges chapter 1, begin in verse 27. Sounds kind of ominous. There's a word, however. That doesn't sound good. It could have been really good. However, Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth-shean. They might have killed some of them. They might have driven some of them out. But in the tribal area of Manasseh, they didn't get rid of all of them. They didn't follow the plan, original intent. Manasseh did not drive out all the inhabitants in their tribal areas. Near the end of verse 27, it says, the Canaanites were determined to dwell in that land. They weren't going to go without some persuasion. The persuasion of hornets is off the table. That God would just strike fear in it, that's off the table. Israel, by virtue of armed conflict, was going to have to persuade them. They were determined to stay. Well, what about some of the other areas? Verse 28, it came to pass when Israel was strong that they put the Canaanites under tribute, but did not completely drive them out. God, you said drive them all out or kill them. We got a better idea. Let's make them our slaves. They'll do all the hard work for us. That's a better idea, isn't it? Nope. So they thought they knew better than God. So they made some of them slaves when they were strong enough to do it. Verse 29, nor did Ephraim. What about the tribe of Ephraim? Did they drive them all out of their area? No. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites who dwelt there among them. Verse 30, how about Zebulun? Now we go up north. What about those tribes up north? Nor did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants, blah, blah, blah. What about verse 30? Did Asher? Nope. Nor did Asher drive out the inhabitants. Why is all this in here? To give us some background about what is this king of Canaan doing there right in the middle of Naphtali when we come to the story of Deborah. They brought it on themselves. Verse 33, we're starting to hone in on the story. Nor did Naphtali. That's where the story of Deborah takes place. Drive out the inhabitants of various places. So now I think we have a better understanding of why there is a king of Canaan named Jabin, an oppressive king into whose power God has sold his people up there in Naphtali and those surrounding areas. And it's been going on for a while. Why has it been going on for a while? Israel brought it on themselves. Let's don't blame God. Many of their troubles were of their own making. Now, I mentioned earlier on in the introduction, these stories are here for a number of reasons. Included among them is hope. The picture we've painted right now is almost hopeless. But there is hope. There is hope in this story if we just know where to find it. So now, Judges 4, let's get right into the story. We have the background. I think we can go through the story fairly quickly. Judges 4, beginning in verse 3, we covered verses 1 and 2. The children of Israel cried out to the Eternal, for Jabin had 900 chariots of iron, and for 20 years he had harshly oppressed the children of Israel. God had sold his people up there into this man's power. And it hadn't lasted just a month. 20 years. How long do you suppose it took for Israel to realize they'd brought this on themselves and to cry out for God to help them? I don't think it took 20 years. But the very instant God cried out to them, he didn't deliver them. He let this go on for 20 years. Some learning to do. He said, you're a stiff-necked people. Maybe it takes you a while to learn a lesson. But now it's time. And so God is going to hear their prayers and he's going to deliver them. And so there is hope. God hasn't just abandoned them. I gave you one chance. You blew it. I'm going to start working with other people. He has not abandoned the Israel project. Verse 4, we come to one of the two key figures in this story. Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time. When it's God's time to help, he sends help. When it's God's time to send a judge, he sends a judge, a delivering judge. The last time he was in with Ehud, he's dead. Now he sends a woman. She's not only a prophetess, she's a judge. She's judging Israel. She's actually the chief authority figure in the whole nation. Verse 5, she would sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the mountains of Ephraim. Now think about that. Again, if you have referenced your maps at the back of your Bible, where the action is just to the west of the Sea of Galilee. That's up in the northern tribes. Where is this delivering prophetess and judge stationed? Way down south. Southern Ephraim. A lot closer to Jerusalem. So God didn't use a person that was right there to deliver these northern tribes. She's operating way down south. They have to come to her for help. And the children of Israel came to her for judgment. She wasn't right there among them. They had to go seek her out. Maybe there's a little humility there. They have to go out of their way to show God, we really need your help. The children of Israel came up to her for judgment, meaning to the mountains around southern Ephraim. So then she sent and called for Barak. Who's Barak? Well, he's the leading military man, such as they have in Israel. They didn't have much of an army. But if they were going to have an army, and if it was going to be led by a general, this is the guy. Who's calling the shots here? In whose hands is the initiative? Her, not him. Not any him, her. She sent and called for him. Now he lives up there in Naphtali, Kadesh of Naphtali. He's got to go down to her. And she starts telling him what God wants done. Has not the eternal God of Israel commanded? She is telling him what God has commanded to be done, and he needs to do it. So this is as if God commanded Barak directly. He's using the mouthpiece of his prophetess. She is speaking on behalf of God, and she says, this is what God has commanded. You, Barak, go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor. That's back in the middle of Naphtali, way up north. Get together an army. Take with you 10,000 men of the son of Naphtali and of the sons of Zebulun. That's the adjoining tribe. Go do it. Now who's giving orders to Barak? Deborah. What's the source of those orders? God. Verse 7. Against you, against this army, I want you to muster and get ready. I, God, will deploy Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army. So God says, get ready, and I'm going to have the other guys come attack you. That's how this is going to play out. And they're not just going to come and attack you. They're going to come and attack you in a way it looks like they'll destroy you. Because they have iron chariots. You don't. You have sticks and stones. Basically, the army of Israel had sticks and stones. The army of Sisera has 900 iron chariots. This looks like a mismatch. This is how God's going to deliver us. He's going to send overwhelming force against us that we don't have a chance to withstand. That's the way you would look at it through human eyes. If you're Barak, you would be terrorized by 900 iron chariots. That's iron against flesh and blood. Now again, we are way, way past the best solution. Trusting God, watching the hornets do their thing. The hardness of Israel's heart in times past, on up till now, off the table. You're going to have to put together a 10,000-person army armed with very crude weapons, and you're going to have to stand there and be attacked by 900 iron chariots and countless other Canaanite soldiers. Well, if God tells Barak what to do, what's Barak supposed to do? He's supposed to do it. So let's see how Barak responded to this command from God. Verse 8, Barak said to her, maybe, I might do it. I've got conditions. That doesn't sound too good. If you, Deborah, a woman, will go with me. In fact, if you'll lead us into battle, I'll go. And if you don't go with me, I'm not going. Now, I just want to ask you what your opinion of Barak is right at that moment. When you just read that, what's your opinion of Barak? Hold your fire, but maybe you have an opinion about Barak based on what we just read. God gives a command. He says, I might do it, I might not. Here are my conditions, and if you don't go with us, I'm not going. I'm not going to do it. Well, verse 9, maybe we didn't expect this answer, but she says, okay, I'll go with you. I'll lead you. I'll go right with you. I will surely go with you. She says, but you know what, Barak, based on what you just said, there are consequences. Whether it's ancient times or modern times, there's a lot of glory that comes down on the winning side of any war. The generals, the leaders get the credit. They get the glory. And that was the same. That's the way people think about it. If Israel's army wins this battle, it doesn't look like they can, but if they do, somebody's going to get a lot of credit, a lot of praise, a lot of glory. Normally it would go to their general. The prophetess of God says, you're not going to get it. You're not going to get the glory. A woman is. Now at this point, she just says that. A woman. Verse 9. I'll go with you. Nevertheless, there will be no glory for you in the journey you're taking. The Eternal will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. So you're not going to be the conquering hero with all the glory. A woman's going to get that honor. And Barak might have thought that Deborah was talking about herself. She's a woman. She's calling the shots. Again, let's hold our judgment. So Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh. What woman would get all this glory? Remember I told you there's two key figures. They're both women. One of them has a name up until now. One is, we've just called, the sweet assassin. Let's read on. Verse 11. Now, Heber, the Kenite, the children of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, had separated himself from the Kenites and pitched his tent near the terebinth trees at Zanum, which is beside Kadesh. And you read that and you say, so what? What's that got to do with anything? You're just telling about some people that might have been indirectly related to Moses and where they're living. Well, it turns out the second woman is among those people. If we had the time, which we don't, we could go into some of the history there. These are the descendants of the brother-in-law of Moses. And you put all the accounts, it says father-in-law, but the Hebrew scholars tell us it's a word that could mean any in-law relationship. And when you put all the accounts together, it's his brother-in-law, Moses' wife's brother that's being described here. Now those people kind of broke off, and they're nomads, and they're living out in the middle of nowhere. They kind of get along with the Israelites there, and they kind of get along with the Canaanites. They just want to be left alone. And all we just heard was they're out there in their tents. But that becomes a very important part of the story. Okay, now we go to verse 12. Now whoever they is, scouts, spies, they reported to Sisera that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor, as he'd been told to do, and he'd gotten his army together, his sticks and stones army. Verse 13. So Sisera gathered together all his chariots, modern terrorizing weaponry, 900 chariots of iron, and all the people who were with him from this region, this wooded region around there, Harosheth Hagoyim, to the river Kishon. This certainly seems to be a mismatch, flesh and blood against iron. And it is. The iron guys didn't have a chance. This is a mismatch. People with iron chariots didn't have a chance because God's on the side of the other people. Verse 14, Deborah said to Barak, up. Again, she's inciting him to do something. She's calling the shots. For this is the day in which the Eternal has delivered Sisera into your hand. Has not the Eternal gone out before you? So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. So the king of Canaan's army under Sisera attacks from the west, and Barak and his army, led by a woman, attack from the east, and they meet. Now when you go to the fifth chapter of Judges, the poetic recounting of this mentions weather and mud. We get a few details of what happened. Chapter 4 doesn't give us a lot of details. God is also not only in control of hornets and fear, and fire, he's in charge of weather. Apparently, God sent an incredible thunderstorm. deluge of rain. What happens to iron chariots pulled by horses in a quagmire? They all get buried in the mud. They become absolutely useless. So immediately, the initiative goes over to the more agile foot soldiers of Israel. God has neutralized the iron chariots. All it takes is a couple of feet of mud. And God can produce mud. Water to make mud. All right, so verse 15, the Eternal routed Sisera. Yeah. And all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. So what's happening, in your mind's eye, you see the army of Canaan coming from the west. You see the army of Israel coming from the east. There's a clash. There's a mud pit. All the iron chariots are disabled. And it soon becomes obvious who has the upper hand. So all the Canaanites retreat. They go back to the west from which they came, except one person, their general. He gets out of his chariot and he heads east. Where is he headed? He's seeing, if I can get across the Jordan River, I'll be in more friendly territory. So he is on foot, running from this battle scene. Sisera is. So verse 17. Sisera, the general, had fled away on foot, and he comes to the tent of Jael. Jael, we'll just call her Jael. Maybe Jael is a good way to pronounce it. We see what's about to happen. He's about ready to break into jail. He comes to the tent of this jail, and who is she? Well, she is the wife of Heber the Canaanite. We just read about who these Canaanites were a minute ago. So he finds this kind of isolated outpost of these nomads who kind of get along with both sides. He thinks he's in neutral ground. He's exhausted. He's been on foot. He's hungry, thirsty, and tired. But he thinks he's reached safety. He fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber, the Kenite. There was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. These people are neutral. These are the Swiss of their day. They are neutral. So here we meet Jael, the sweet assassin. If there's one thing you can say about Jael is when she's given a job to do, she does it thoroughly. There was nothing halfway about what she's about to do. Verse 18. Jael went out to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord. Turn aside to me. Do not fear." So sweet. And when he had turned aside with her into the tent, she tucked him in, covered him with a blanket. Very sweet. Sisera has no idea about what's to happen. Verse 19, he said to her one last thing. He's drowsy. He says, "I'm thirsty. Please give me a little water to drink. I'm thirsty." Now, the next sentence kind of is surprising to us. She opened a jug of milk. Now, if you have a raging thirst, you want milk? He asked for water. And you read the historians, and they say this isn't really just milk. It's kind of a thick, syrupy, almost a yogurt, a curdled milk. It's a drink called Laban. And he says, the Arabs to this day, it's one of their Coca-Cola. They love this to this day. Kind of a thick, curdled milk. Well, anyway, he took it. She gave him a drink, and she covered him up. She's just so sweet. By the way, her name in Hebrew means mountain goat. I don't know if that adds to the story or not. But Jael means mountain goat. So verse 20. And just as he's nodding off to sleep, one last thing, sweet Jael. "Stand at the door of the tent." Guard me, will you? "Stand at the door of the tent. If any man comes," any man, translated any Israelite, especially Barak, "if any man comes and inquires of you and says, 'Is there any man here?' Say, 'Nope.'" She doesn't say anything in reply. So sweet. So quiet. Then what happens? Verse 21. "Then Jael, Hebrew's wife, she took a tent peg, she took a hammer, she went softly to him, and she drove the peg into his temple. And it went down into the ground. for he was fast asleep. Well, I would say if he wasn't fast asleep before, he was now. And then in one of the great understatements in all literature, he died. I would say that'll do it. That'll do it. That'll lead to death. I think he's probably dead. Fast asleep. Historians tell us about these nomadic Arab people in that time or this time. It says it usually was the women's job. It was their responsibility for setting up and taking down the tents. So Jael knew how to use these implements. She knew how to use a tent peg and a hammer. If you doubt me, just ask Sisera next time you see him. She was pretty good. Verse 22. As Barak pursued Sisera, now there's going to be some glory because now Israel has won the battle. Who's going to get the glory? I think Barak's still hoping it might be him. So he's pursuing Sisera, and he comes to this place, and Jael came out to meet him. She's back in sweet mode, I think, and said to him, "Come, I'll show you the man whom you seek." And when he came into her tent, there lay Sisera, dead, with the peg in his temple, all the way through both temples into the ground. So on that day, Barak subdued Jabin. No, it doesn't say that. God subdued Jabin. And the glory doesn't go to any man, really, or any woman. For those with spiritual perception, it goes to God. But for those who don't have that, it's got to go to a human being, and it's not going to go to any man. It's not going to go to Barak. It's going to go to Jael. Verse 24, and the hand of the children of Israel grew stronger and stronger against Jabin, the king of Canaan, until they had destroyed Jabin, the king of Canaan. I thought I'd share this with you. One scholar commented, now you talk about understatement, commented on this whole incident and said, this was what Jael did to Sisera. Said this was a startling violation of the usual laws of hospitality. I think I would agree with that. That is a violation of the usual laws of hospitality. Well, maybe one or two more points before we end this. What is your opinion of Barak? We've read the story. The two main characters were ladies. We saw what Barak did, kind of reluctantly. We saw his reaction to a command from God. What is your thought about Barak? Do you think that I have read the last time in the Bible where the name Barak is mentioned? Well, actually, I haven't. It's mentioned one more time. Some of you know where it is, but maybe some of you don't. The name Barak is mentioned one more time in the Bible, and this too is rather surprising. It's mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11, the heroes of faith. The people we are going to see in the first resurrection. Let's read it. Hebrews 11. You know, there's hope in these stories. That's one of their purposes. Is there hope for a person who starts out kind of weak, faithless, provisional in their willingness to do what God asked them to do, contingent? Is there a chance for that person, or do they blow it with their first kind of weak response? Any hope for Barak? Now, it's true, he didn't get the glory among men for this victory. But what about at the end of the day where it really matters? Hebrews 11, this is a listing of people from Old Testament times that we believe we'll see in the first resurrection. Verse 32, what more shall I say to you? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon, and look at there, Barak, and Samson, and Jephthah, of David, Samuel, the prophets. I would say Barak is in pretty good company. When he's mentioned there, is there any hope? Can people learn from their mistakes? Can people learn from weak responses to God? And can they grow out of that? Is there hope for them? I think there is. I think there's hope for Barak. If there's hope for Barak, there's hope for me, there's hope for you. I think he's in very good company. So yes, in these stories, true stories, which God has caused to be recorded, not only that they happened, but they were recorded for our learning. Even in the worst of times, There's a lot of good for us. There's a lot of example. There's learning. Same things we started the sermon. There's learning. There's warning. There's admonishment. But there's also hope. There's a lot of hope. I guess one other observation in all of these stories, what's the one common element? God. God is either obvious or he's behind the scenes if you know where to look. God is involved with his people. To people who had spiritual perception, God got the credit for that victory. Now, for those who didn't, okay, they gave it to a woman, they gave it to Jael. But we have the benefit of realizing what's going on. God is the common element in all of this. His wisdom, his timing, his perfect mixture of mercy and judgment. I hope it's been helpful to all of us to review the story of Deborah and Jael. I hope we can see how these stories are beneficial in many ways for us today, upon whom the ends of the ages have come.